does have it all. All of our pre-owned vehicles are Hubler Q certified, which include a 128-point vehicle inspection, a free Carfax vehicle history report, and two warranties. A two-year, 100,000-mile powertrain warranty, and a 30-day, 1,000-mile comprehensive warranty. Visit any of our 13 locations today, or click drivehubler.com. Hubler has it
all. Joining us now on the Mower Shop and Fishers hotline to check out everything with the Mower Shop and Fishers. Go to mowershop.com for all your snowblowers, commercial, residential mowers, plus service and power tools. Mike Chappell joins us. Chap, how are you?
Good. How are you guys doing?
Good. Hey, you and I go back to when this team first moved here. Now, you've been through a lot
you
of
disappointment. You and I go back to Anderson.
Right. Way back. Back to the wigwam. But you've been through a lot of disappointing seasons. Is this the most disappointing season that you've encountered with the Indianapolis Colts, considering what the expectations were and what the results were?
Yeah, the fact that you mentioned the expectations, that's what makes it top two or three. And if I had time to really think about it, maybe something would hit me. But no, the fact that and what people need to realize is this wasn't a locally fueled optimism. This was national. I mean, you know, Vegas. Vegas is the one that had these guys a slight favor to win the AFC South. It just wasn't us pushing this. So, and there was reason. That there really was. Things they had done, and we thought, you know, we bought in that Matt Ryan would be the right guy, and I thought he would be if everything else worked. You know, the running game, the offensive line, and all that, which – it didn't. So, yeah, considering what the expectations were, and then how not just that it that it fell short, but it just flamed out. I mean, holy smokes, you fire your coach. First time that Jim Harbaugh says fired a coach in season. And then you go outside the box, way outside the box with Jeff Saturday. I didn't agree at the time, and, you know, I never thought it would have mattered anyway who he brought in. This thing was so broken. But then to have it just disintegrate, you know, Dallas, Minnesota, and not being competitive and all that. Yeah, if this isn't the worst, somebody needs to tell me what was, because all things being equal, this was a dumpster fire.
Chap, I got a kick out of some of the local media talking about how hard it was to cover this team late in the year. And I would always think about you. You and I both covered those teams back in the mid-'80s. That's when it was hard.
You know, whenever someone says that, I say, you know, I was here for 1-15 in 91, and they scored like 140. They averaged 8.6 points a game. 8.6. And every game it was, well, Dean Biasucci kicked a couple field goals. And it took the comeback in against the Jets, if I remember right, 25-24, whatever it was. Or they would have been 0-16. So, yeah, this is bad. And, again, it's amplified by the expectations. They've had worse teams. They have had worse teams. And, you know, you and I can say, yes, we saw them. But the hard part is how do you turn this around? And it's gonna take a couple of years. They have to hit on three or four things in the off season, and it's still gonna take a couple of years to get this turned around.
Chap, when you look up and down this roster, and I know it's sad from a fan perspective to look at the team as a carcass right now, but that's kind of how the season unfolded, unfortunately. You talk about multi-years, and I think you, Brian, and I are in agreement on that where they want to go is going to be not just a one-off season project. It's going to be multiple off seasons. When you look up and down this roster, which pieces right now in your mind are most movable or most attractive should the Colts want to maybe fine-tune things or maybe get different aspects of their roster either off the books or try to gain, either get younger or get more capital in the draft?
Well, you've got like, I'm going to address it like this week or early next week, they've got like 20 free agents.
Right.
So you start there. And not a lot of guys, you say, man, we've got to bring him back. Some good players, but not like, you know, Shaq Leonard and people like that to where you've got to re-sign these guys. Like Bobby Okereke, Paris Campbell, those type of guys who you'd really like back probably, but we'll see. I think it's without question that Matt Ryan and Nick Foles are gone. I see absolutely zero chance. No, not a, very little chance that they're back. You know, Matt Ryan comes back and he counts $35 million. And if you get rid of him, you know, you save $17 million, which is a lot of personnel capital that you can invest elsewhere. But I just don't see them dumping players for cap space. I just don't see that. I've seen some, you know, the one thing that's great about the one thing that's good and bad about the internet is you get all the wacko ideas on how you trade up to one to get it, the number one pick in Chicago, and it's, or you trade Shaq and Jonathan Taylor or Pittman and picks. And, you know, I don't know. You know, maybe Chicago doesn't want your guys. Now, Eberflus would love to have Kenny Moore and DeForest Buckner, but I just don't know how viable that is. So, you know, there are really good pieces in place. There are. You know, this defense, without Shaq, played at a winning level, at a playoff level, until it simply wore out and ran out of bodies and whatever. And you just have to believe that the offensive line will play better. And you got to hope that Bernhard Raimann showed you enough over the last half of the season that he can be the guy. And he had some rough moments, but I think over the last half of the year, he played pretty well. But the other guys have got to lift their games again. Braden Smith played well last two-thirds of the season. Brian Kelly played better at the end. But, and again, Quentin Nelson, that just wasn't him. It just wasn't. And you've got to figure out right guard. So, you know, it can be fixed. You got Pittman. You got Alec Pierce is going to be a solid receiver. And, you know, is Pitt a number one? I don't know. I sort of say no. But what they have, their passing game was so bad this year, I don't know how you evaluate their receivers. Jonathan Taylor is still an elite running back. So there are pieces in place. But until you get the quarterback right, none of it matters.
Yeah, I agree with you as far as the wide receivers are concerned. They couldn't throw the ball downfield, so how could you properly evaluate that group of receivers? But is it dangerous for the Colts to stay in the four slot and get the player that they really want?
Yes. Oh, yes. Because, again, what we don't know, and it's still so early in the process, is how does Ballard evaluate these three or four quarterbacks? You know, maybe he's got everybody sold on this one guy as number one. Well, maybe he's got somebody else, you know, number one, number two. You just don't know. But the only way to get your guy is to be at one. You know, as the Colts when they had Peyton Manning and Ryan Leaf or Andrew Luck and NRG3. The only way to get your guy is to be at one. To sit at four, you know, would three quarterbacks go one, two, three? Probably not. Although, keep in mind, somebody below you very well can jump up and get one of those spots to get that guy. So you just don't know. And if the Colts don't move to one, somebody will. So it's the only way to guarantee to get your guy is to move up. And then, you know, what's it cost? Well, we've talked in the press room. For the most part, you pay whatever the cost is. Now you don't mortgage the franchise, but there you have to do pretty much whatever it takes to get the guy. Because like I said, until you get the guy, I would argue, and I'm probably wrong, I would argue that getting the quarterback right is more important than getting the coach right. And I'm sure I'm wrong, but it just feels right, because I don't care who your coach is. We've seen a lot of really good coaches flail away because they haven't got the right quarterback, and we've seen some quarterbacks, you know, overcome a bad roster or suspect coaching. So you've got to get that right, and the only way to do it, if there's a guy that you just believe is, it's like one, and then there's a drop off to two and three, then you go up and get it. But if there's two or three guys, I suppose you could trade up to two or three. Sitting at four, you're just taking a chance you're not going to get your guy, and then where are you?
Chap, to Brian's point, is there any buzz around which way they're leaning in terms of what direction they'd want to go at four if they wait?
No, you mean is like the Kentucky kid or something?
Right, yeah, in terms of available, is there any lean at this point, or are we still very early in that process?
It's so early in the process.
Sure.
Now, they've been doing their work
right
during the season.
Right.
But right now they've got, you know, Ballard's got to be multitasking because he's carrying on this coaching search as well. But they don't have, if you put a gun to their head right now, they could make an educated guess, but they are so far away from having to make that decision and really diving in to the process to where it's, okay, now let's really start lining these guys up. So, and again, I think over the next month or 2 months, if you hear that, well, we hear the Colts like this guy, I guess I'd call BS, because I think, you know, very few personnel guys, GMs, share their information. I mean, why would you?
Right.
Why would you put in all the legwork and all this and then call your buddy at ESPN or whatever and say, don't spread this around too much, but we like this guy. So, you know, from this point forward, most of what you hear is guesswork or misinformation. But again, it's, you know, everything that everybody points to is that there are four quarterbacks. And if you like all four, sort of the same, sit still and get the one that's there. But like I said, if there's one or two you really like, do what it takes to go and get him.
Mike Chappell, nice enough to join us via the Mower Shop and Fishers hotline and themowershop.com. You can follow Mike Chappell on Twitter at mchappell51. Chappie, in that same vein, Brian brought this up yesterday. I thought it was a great point.
Of course.
How much will the combine impact, based on just Ballard's previous movement in drafts or his decision-making in the draft, how much will the combine, impact this process for the Colts as they presumably take quarterback in the first round?
Well, it's some, but again, I think any GM who has the combine as their number one determinant is probably not a real good GM.
Sure.
It's got his place. Talk to most guys, though, and it's the combine is the physicals. Did they have issues? And, you know, cleaning up whatever questions there might be. And then the sit down with guys. And face-to-face, and how do they present themselves? I remember that when Peyton came out, he said in his interview, he interviewed the Colts. He wanted to know what they were how they were going to do things. I'm not sure if any of these guys are at that level. But I think it's a piece of the puzzle. But, you know, the on-campus visits, guys in games, watching practices, going over game tape, that's what's so important. I just think that the combine, and we've seen what the NFL's done to the combine. They've turned it into like the second or third largest NFL event on the calendar because that's who they are. But I think it's a piece of the puzzle, but boy, it just can't be one of your top two or three pieces. It just can't be because the other things are too much more important.
In terms of the coaching search, do any of the names that have been interviewed or will be interviewed interest you?
Oh, Raheem Morris, maybe. I keep going back and forth on whether they need to have an offensive guy because, you know, young quarterback and all that. And if it's a defensive guy, I really want to know who his staff is offensively. Because what the coordinator and the quarterback coach does is going to impact your franchise. It just will. So I not really yet. I want to see what the second round of interviews are to really see what their mind is. I'd like to have known how much discussion internally they had on the possibility of Jim Harbaugh before Harbaugh took his name out. I do believe there was some level of contact. Now, not Chris Ballard calling Harbaugh or Harbaugh calling the Colts. I think there was some feelers put out. I just do. But I just, The only concerns I have when you look at these hot coordinators, offense and defense, is keep in mind they're not bringing their stud players with them. You know, I go back to when, I'll date myself, when they brought in Ted Marchibroda from Buffalo. Remember, he was a coordinator of that Cajun attack. And we asked Ted, so you guys going to run the Cajun here? He says, well, unless I can bring Kelly and Thurman Thomas and Andre Reed and all these guys, no. So just be careful of why that guy is the great coordinator, just because he's got great players. He's got a great quarterback. He's got great all-pro players. You got to make sure the guy is solid in his own right and not simply because he's got great players. So and that's why you've got to get this right. I still say that I'm more concerned a little bit on the quarterback, but boy, you got to have the right coach. We've seen a lot of places where the right or the wrong coach hasn't worked, and that sets you back. The quarterback sets you back longer because of what you invested in it. So I'm kind of curious who they, when they go through this, talk to 7, 8, 9, 10 guys, and then who is the second round you bring back, which that probably gets the owner involved, is after Ballard has his first round with these guys.
I said this yesterday, Chap, and I may be wrong, but I get the feeling that this is all just window dressing, and at the end of the day, they're going to say, after an exhaustive search, Jeff Saturday is our best choice.
Boy, I I know. I just can't go there. And I tell you, I've talked to a few people out there, and at one point, there was a thought, well, let's just do what we have to do. Let's get the Rooney Rule satisfied. And then, you know, I really like Jeff Saturday, but I just don't know how you sell. First, I'm not sure how you'd sell Ballard on that. He made it very clear that he wasn't on board with Saturday as an interim guy. You're not going to sell that to the fan base. Now, if that doesn't matter, then it doesn't matter. But you're going to have all these 10, 12 guys who have resumes and have had success, to some pretty good success. And then to say, yeah, we're going to go with Jeff. This comes off as a knock on Jeff, and I don't mean it to be. It's just that he's not done this before. What was it, 3 years at the high school level? Because that's not what he was doing. He was being a family guy. He was doing his TV stuff. I just don't know how you line these, let's say, five guys, and consider what each one of them has done. And then you point to the guy that will have the meekest resume. I just don't know how they do that. Maybe they do, because Jimmy will do what he wants to do. I'm not sure how you do that.
Chap, I want to slightly rephrase that question, because I'm in the same boat as you, that I don't know how you can do it. But to clarify or re-ask it a different way, would it surprise you / is it plausible that at the end of the day, Jim Irsay could reach that decision?
Oh, it's plausible. It's his team.
Right. But I mean, like,
yeah.
You've been around it better than anybody and longer than anybody. Would it surprise you if that's ultimately the decision he made at the end of the day?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it would. It would. Just because of he's got Ballard in place. He's keeping Ballard. Ballard's running the coaching search. I would love to sit in that meeting between Chris Ballard and Jeff Saturday. I'd love it. I think it'd be cool. But I just, like I said, I just don't know how, at the end of the day, when Jimmy and Chris Ballard sit down and they go back and forth and this, that, and the other, I just don't think they'll go that way. But again, they could. I don't know what the odds are. 20-80 against. I just don't see it. But it's his team, and he'll do what he darn well pleases.
He's plus 1,000 the last time I checked the sports books for how they were mocking that. That's about 8th or 9th best, but that's about 5 days old. Chap, Art Stapleton tweeted earlier today, Giants beat writer for the Record Sports. He was at Wink Martindale's press conference, and Wink said that He didn't view the job with the Giants as a stepping stone. It was a destination. And he said he'll find time to interview for head coaching jobs like the Colts position, quote, if it's not too late after this weekend. Presumably, if Wink is, which they put a request in, if that is a name near the top of the list for the Colts, they're in no rush. They're willing to let this process play out in the playoffs, right?
Yeah, I mean, remember the last time that they hired a coach, it was mid-February because of playoffs and all that. And then when it didn't work, you had to go back and reload with Frank. So, yeah, they're in no hurry, and they don't need to be. If they're in a hurry, maybe they would have made a push for Harbaugh because they wanted that out of the way. But there's no real reason to hurry with this and kind of check that box off and move to something else. You can multitask. These guys get paid a lot of money to multitask. And Ballard told us at his season ender that this thing may go into mid-February. Because, again, it just makes no sense to try to hurry. And I guess if you wanted to get it done and, you know, go by some of the thinking that's out there, you've already satisfied the Rooney Rule. Then go ahead and name Jeff your head coach because you've done everything you need to do. But I think this will go into February just because they'll want to talk to people more extensive who are in the playoffs, and that takes time.
So we've been talking about this earlier. You know, everybody nationally is talking about Lamar Jackson being traded. Would you trade for him if you're the Colts?
Wow. First, Baltimore would be crazy to trade him.
Right.
I mean, it's so hard to get the guy, and then he's 26, and you're going to trade him? I mean, and it would take probably two first-round picks. I don't know, two plus more. I don't know. Would I? I guess yes, because he's that guy. But then you've got to pay $250 million guaranteed, because that's kind of what he wants now, I guess. He wants more. Would they offer him $133 guaranteed? He said, no thanks. I guess the only issue with getting him, I guess, although they're almost built for it, you're changing how you run your team. You're going to be run first because that's what he is. You're not going to be that dynamic in the pass game. Well, these guys aren't. So I guess there wouldn't be all that much in it to change. That'd be a bold move. I mean, it would be beyond bold. I can't believe that Baltimore would trade away a franchise quarterback who's 26. And then, because again, it's crazy. It's, you can always get rid of players because you don't like them for whatever reason. Then you got to replace them. Well, sometimes we're talking about a guard or a wide receiver or whatever. This is a franchise quarterback. And how far that sets you back to get rid of him is amazing. But it sure seems like that relationship is frayed, beyond frayed. And what happens if they franchise, even say, well, we're going to kick the can down the road and worry about this next offseason. And then Jackson said, well, you know, I'm not playing for the franchise tag. Then where are you? So if I'm the Colts, do I make that trade? Probably. But I can't it's just hard to believe Baltimore would walk away from that kind of a quarterback.
All right, we're up against the break, Chap, but I want to know this before we go. The best game you ever saw in the wigwam?
Ooh, Stu Robinson beaten, was it Highland?
Oh, I remember that game. I'm a Highland grad.
Or Steve Alford missing two free throws for Anderson to beat Newcastle. That's pretty cool. Any one of the Highland-Anderson games – that went like 109 to 105 in overtime. I'm telling you, I was there from 74 to 84, and it was a golden era of basketball at Anderson. Unbelievable.
It's sad to drive by the wigwam now and see what it is now and what it used to be. But, Chap, those are good memories, and thank you for joining us. I appreciate it. And, you know, congratulations on your longevity. In this business, it's unheard of. And you've been with this team, covering this team since they moved to Indianapolis. And congrats on that.
I appreciate it. And, you know, staying power, there's a value to just still being around.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
One morning, you just walk in with a bag of everyone's faves from McDonald's, drop it on the counter, and say, breakfast is on me. Boom! That's the power of saving money on the McDonald's app. Hope you can handle all that. Save money with the app. At participating McDonald's, must opt into rewards.
Pacers tonight take on the Oklahoma City Thunder, and here to talk about it via the Mower Shop and the MowerShop.com hotline is the television voice of the Indiana Pacers, Chris Denari. Chris, how are you, bud?
Hey, I'm doing great, Brian. You could tee it up here in Oklahoma City today. It's 62 degrees, so I'm sure the golf courses are getting a workout today here.
There are some pretty good golf courses in Oklahoma.
Yeah, I've never played. I've never played here in Oklahoma. You know, many years on the road, we'll play at times, but I have never played here in Oklahoma.
So I know you know this because I know how you prepare, but the Pacers have given up over 130 points the last couple of games. The Thunder hung 150 on the Celtics recently, and they're averaging 125 points per game over the last eight. So I'm guessing defense might be a focus tonight?
No question. I mean, this is an Oklahoma City team that's the youngest in the NBA, and like the Pacers, much improved. They're just a couple of games away from matching their win total of last year. And you're right, they scored 150 here against Boston, and they're coming in with three straight wins and very impressive. I mean, they won in Philadelphia, they won in Chicago, and they won in Brooklyn on Sunday, and all those wins on the road were double figures. So, yeah, I mean, the Pacers just played two of the better offensive teams in the league in Memphis and Milwaukee, and there's no question that this is a very talented young team. They only averaged 104 points a game last year, and they're averaging 116 now. They've got the fifth leading scorer in the NBA in Shea Gilgeous-Alexander. They got him in the Paul George trade when PG went from Oklahoma City to the Clippers. So he's a very talented player. They've got a really good point guard from Australia in Josh Giddey. So this is a team that nobody in the league can sleep on, and it'll be fascinating to watch tonight because there will be a lot of young players, Brian, on the floor. I made a note here. Oklahoma City has nine players 22 years and younger, and the Pacers have six. So that's 15 of your 30 players on the roster that are 22 years of age and younger.
All right, now there's two Jalen Williams in the starting lineup. How are you going to handle that?
We've talked about that. I mean, this is a bizarre – I've not seen this. The only other time I had to deal with this, and they didn't have the same name, but when I did U Indy basketball back in the 80s, there were three brothers that all started for Lewis, and they were the Niego brothers. And you just basically said their first names. So I don't know how I'm going to react to this because you have Jalen Williams, J-A-L-E-N. He's a rookie out of Santa Clara. And the other one is Jaylen, J-A-Y-L-I-N. And he's a rookie out of Arkansas. At least one is 6'10", and the other is 6'6". So you should be able to distinguish between them.
And that's such a funny conundrum. I'm dealing with that similarly at Roncalli right now. They got the Kegaris brothers, Luke and Drew. But again, to your point, Chris, at least there's a distinction there. You can go your U Indy route of first names, but I mean, you can't say Jalen with a Y or Jalen with an E on the right side.
No, I think you just have to say one of the Williams. You just say Williams and then try to clarify it at some point.
You mentioned, and Brian led off that obviously defense being an important aspect, but Andrew Nembhard, the star rookie guard, has continued to shine, particularly on that front, and is likely to match up with Shea Gilgeous-Alexander a number of times tonight. What will that test be like for the rookie?
Well, he's somebody that you just look at every team, you know, Trae Young, Ja Morant. I mean, he was guarding LeBron James out in L.A. This is a young man that, is a very talented player. He's hit a little bit of a wall here offensively. He's not shot the ball very well the last three games, but you're talking about getting a lot of experience for a guy like Nembhard and then also Benedict Mathurin. I mean, these are two guys that are usually on the floor in clutch situations down the stretch. So, I'm sure Nembhard, he looks at this as a huge challenge each and every night, and he'll be tasked with trying to slow down Gilgeous-Alexander.
Okay, let's get back to the names real quick. Now, I've had to deal with, when I would do an LPGA event especially, I mean, there were some names that were really off the charts, hard to deal with. What's the most difficult name that you have to deal with in the NBA?
There's one that I constantly, Brian, have to look down at my sheet, and I was very happy that he did not get on the floor on Monday in Milwaukee. And Butler fans may remember him because he played at Seton Hall, but his name is Sandro Mamukelashvili.
Oh, my God.
I mean, there are a lot of syllables there. Mamukelashvili. I'm sure if I did his games on a regular basis, it would just roll off my tongue. It's similar to, think back to the 2000s when the Pacers got Šarūnas Jasikevičius. And I remember I was the sports director, Brian, at Channel 59 when that trade was made. And, you know, trying to say that name over and over. And then I got the Pacers job and actually called his games. It was much easier when you said it night after night. But, yeah, Sandro Mamukelashvili is to me, I think, one of the harder names in the league.
That dude needs a nickname in the worst way. Now, this, I would think, Chris, that, you know, when this season started, the expectations weren't very high. I would think this has to have been, so far, one of the more enjoyable seasons for you personally.
There's no question. I mean, when you, especially when you, like we are, we're back out on the road. I had not traveled for 2.5 years, so I'm back out on the road with the coaches and the players, and you get to know them more than I did the last couple of years when you just didn't have the opportunity to build those relationships. And you see just the camaraderie and the togetherness that this group has. A lot of people want to say that culture and chemistry doesn't matter, and you know, I think any of us that have been around this know that that's not true. You still have to have great talent. Don't get me wrong. You've got to have really good talent to win. But it really helps, especially when you're young, that you have a group of players that get along and they root for each other. And I think fans can sense that when they watch on television, but especially when they come to Gainbridge Fieldhouse, how much fun this group has together. And so, yeah, it's been really, really refreshing. And I think, you know, the front office has done a really good job putting this roster together. And you've got a really good young core that I think is going to be together for some time, and that's exciting to see.
Chris, and I had forgotten about this. You've probably gotten this question a ton, but being back on the road and having that long absence with the COVID-19 pandemic and the decision-making of getting broadcasters back out there, where is your favorite non-Gainbridge Fieldhouse Division arena as you travel around the country with the team throughout the season?
Well, it probably depends now where they put us. We're probably about half-half as far as being up and down, as far as, you know, down on the scorer's bench or like we are at Gainbridge Fieldhouse at the table just between the bench and the scorer's bench. So, for instance, Monday, for the first time in Milwaukee, we were up. Utah, I felt like I was on the moon broadcasting the game. Here in Oklahoma City, we'll be right down on the scorer's bench. So part of it depends on, you know, where you are. I will say, and it's, you know, it's one of the older buildings in the league, but I was there last week. Going to Madison Square Garden, there's just something special about that. I mean, they always have a great crowd, no matter how good or bad they are. It's, you know, it's the world's most famous arena. Now, I believe that Gainbridge Fieldhouse is the best basketball arena in the country, in the world. And what Pacers Sports and Entertainment and the Capital Improvement Board have done over the last 3 years to make those improvements, it's fantastic. But, you know, there are a lot of great environments. This used to be, you know, when they had Durant and Harden and Westbrook.
Yeah.
This place was crazy. Portland still has a great fan base. But going around the league, there are a lot of great places, you know, to do games. I'm very thankful I get to do it. But now sometimes it's all based on where are we located and what is our view, because that makes it a whole lot easier to call the game.
Hey, they can sell those seats down low for an awful lot of money. That's why they stick you up in the nosebleeds at some of these arenas. Now, I'm hearing, Chris, from people inside the organization, and yeah, I do still have some contacts, good things about Buddy Hield. I mean, it was a foregone conclusion when he came here that he wasn't going to last long here, but I'm hearing really good things about him, not just the way he's playing, but what he means in the locker room. What are you seeing there?
Yeah, no question. I mean, this guy, the thing that I've said about both he and Tyrese is they brought a level of joy with the way that they play and the way that they're around their teammates, whether it's on the bus or in the locker room. And I just think that happiness is contagious and it carries over. And so, you know, having not watched a lot of Buddy before he got here, you know, I just thought he was a three-point shooter. And clearly he's a very good three-point shooter. I just made a note in the last 23 games, and so that's half of what the Pacers have played. He's shooting nearly 50% from three-point range. But it's his rebounding, his passing. He had a blocked shot critical in a game just recently. You know, he does a lot of things on the floor that I don't think people thought he could do. And, you know, this will be interesting for him tonight because just about a half hour south is where he played his college basketball at Oklahoma. So it's a little bit of, you know, a coming home for him tonight with the game against the Thunder.
Chris, we talked about this a little bit yesterday. Chris Denary, nice enough to join us, the TV voice of the Pacers on Bally Sports via the Mower Shop and Fishers hotline and themowershop.com. We talked about this a little bit yesterday, and it was shown in Milwaukee at times, the Pacers over this four-game skid. It's been a handful of runs that have kind of death by a thousand paper cuts, the Pacers, the last couple of nights. And at times without Tyrese Halliburton, it's felt like the offense maybe missed a counterpuncher out there to respond to those runs. When you look at Oklahoma City tonight, they're obviously a fast-paced team in general, and they have gifted guards as well. Where do the Pacers need to either adjust or fine-tune things offensively to respond when those runs arrive?
Yeah, T.J. McConnell said that after the game, and he had just a career game on Monday, 29 points. He had 25 in the first half, but he said, hey, no disrespect to myself or Andrew Nembhard, we missed Tyrese Halliburton. And if you look at it, you know, the Pacers have won 16 games that are considered clutch this year, and that's tied for first in the NBA. But they've lost three straight at New York, the Atlanta game, and then Milwaukee on Monday. And the fourth quarter this year is really where Tyrese Halliburton has shined. And so you've got to try to overcome that with, you know, with whoever's out there handling the ball, and that's Nembhard or McConnell. So that'll be something to watch, you know, just how the Pacers handle those late-game situations because, really, they've been good this year. I mean, they had a stretch where they went 7-1 in late-game situations, but now without Tyrese Halliburton, you're just taking one more player who can get you a basket late or make a right decision. They just don't have that right now. So collectively, they're going to have to find a way to overcome that.
You know, you look at this stretch of games for the remainder of this month, that's an important stretch. It could really decide whether or not this team is a playoff team or not.
Yeah, I mean, you go back to the Memphis game on Saturday. They're second in the West. Milwaukee's battling for, you know, first in the East. Denver on Friday night is the number one team of the West, and they've got the two-time defending MVP and Jokic. Next week you've got Chicago. You've got a Friday Sunday where you play Milwaukee and Memphis, and then you start February, Brian. You've got the Lakers, Sacramento, and Cleveland at home, and then you go on the road at Miami. I always say this. You know, when Brad Stevens made the move from Butler to the Celtics, you know, back during the 13-14 season, and, you know, they only won like 25 or 26 games before he got them turned around. We're in his office at TD Garden, and he was just joking, and he said, and again, I don't want to be disrespectful to another college, but he said something to the point, he goes, hey, I asked Danny Ainge if we could get Elon on the schedule, and it just wasn't possible. there are 30 teams in the NBA. They all have former college All-Americans. And as I've said, you look at Oklahoma City, they're two games under 500, and they've got really good talent. So it's a tough stretch, and you just have to do your best to get through it. I think, you know, what the Pacers did back before Christmas, they went on the road and won back-to-back games at Miami and Boston, and I really thought that gave them a lot of confidence. They just need to, you know, get a win here to regain that confidence going in, you know, as we're in the second half of the season.
Chris, a lot of us were surprised, at least I was, at how fast this turnaround came for the Pacers this year. And like you mentioned, it as Brian asked you earlier, it's some of the most fun you've had in a little bit calling the Pacers, and fans are feeling the same way. Gainbridge is packed, and it's fun to follow the Pacers, where last year it had, you know, its ups and downs at times. for you and Quinn, as you kind of navigate through this schedule as well, to Brian's point, what do you need to see out of this group until Halliburton returns? Maybe not like a necessarily win-loss mark, but where do you want to see continued improvements to know that, okay, even when Tyrese is back, this team's still going to be in the driver's seat of getting a postseason spot or even a play-in spot this year?
Yeah, I think individual players just have to play a little bit better. You've got to avoid slumps, especially on the offensive end. I mean, somebody like Aaron Nesmith, he had an 11-game stretch where he had 10 in double figures. He's averaging 14 points, and now he's come back after an illness, and he's really struggled shooting the ball. Chris Duarte coming back from the injury, he went 14 or 15 games just in a real struggle. And he's had two pretty good games, coming in the last two against Memphis and Milwaukee. So individually, a number of these players just, if you can raise your individual game, it really helps, your overall team. And that's why I think from a defensive end, too, you'll hear coaches, trying to be tied together defensively. But it all starts to make sure you're guarding your man. They always say guard your yard. And if you can take care of your yard, then that helps, with the other yards that are out there in the half-court defense. So I think it's each individual player just has to do a little bit better, and I think collectively that will help the team.
One follow-up in that regard, and we had a caller reference this earlier in the show, and then the Pacers have since tweeted it out. Benedict Mathurin continues to shine as a rookie, but at least in terms of a minimum of 30 games, he's now the most points per game leader by a player off the bench ever with 17.5 a game. Obviously, that's a nice stat, but Chris, he's impressed a lot of us. I'm sure he's impressed you as well. Where has this rookie season, maybe not ranked, but where has it shown the most for you at what a promising budding young star he is, along with this whole rookie class?
Yeah, I think his ability to get to the free throw line. I mean, you just don't see young players get to the line. He's 22nd in the NBA. He's averaging more than 6 free throw attempts per game. And I think over the last 10, he's like 8 or 9 free throw attempts. And, Quinn will tell you, any really good scorer, the reason you have a high scoring average is because you get to the free throw line. So I think that's been huge for him. He has a competitive fire that is second to none. Just being around him, you're always happy when you see him smile because he is very serious about his craft. I mean, the fact of the matter is this Benedict Mathurin wants to be the best player that he can be. He wants to be the best player in the NBA, and this guy puts in a tremendous amount of work. I think we all thought he would have a good rookie year, but I don't think any of us thought that he'd be the leading bench scorer in the NBA or averaging 17 points per game. I mean, he's had an outstanding first half of the season, and it's exciting to see what his career could be for this franchise.
What's your gut feeling as we approach the trade deadline? Are the Pacers going to do anything?
It's hard to know. I mean, you just don't know what's going to happen. I do know that they really like this group, and they really like how they've come together. But I would say that throughout the league, I mean, I read everything like everybody else does about all the teams, and, usually 75% of the things that are out there never happen. So I think it'll be, closer to, the end of the month, 1st of February. I mean, I think the trade deadline's the first week of February. It'll be interesting to see what teams do as far as how they're going to position themselves, not just for this year, but for the future.
All right, put your general manager's hat on. What piece or pieces would you add to this team to take it to the next level?
Well, I think as they move forward, with their young core, I mean, I think you can always, add a veteran that has a lot of experience. I mean, if you look over the years at what the Pacers have been able to do, I mean, one of the great, signings was signing David West. I think that, enabled the Pacers to go to the Eastern Conference Finals back-to-back years in 13 and 14. So, the great thing that the front office has done is they put themselves in fantastic position from a financial standpoint, from contract standpoint, to play these young guys this year, but knowing they've got plenty of cap space. I mean, Kevin Pritchard uses the word optionality, and the Pacers have plenty of optionality moving forward. And if you look at a number of the other teams across the landscape of the NBA, I mean, they don't have a lot of opportunity to do anything. And so I think that's the great thing that the Pacers have moving forward, and they're super excited about what they've been able to build. And again, through 45 games, I think if anybody would have said they'd have 23 wins and be over 500 right now, nobody would have thought that. So even despite a four-game losing streak, I think people are very pleased with where this franchise is right now.
Chris, there's a number of reasons for the Pacers to be happy to have Rick Carlisle at the helm, but the conversations as we get closer and closer to the deadline are going to continue to follow this team a little bit, in particular Miles Turner, and if the Pacers are going to extend him or if they'll move him, whatever they do. How important and what a luxury is that for the Pacers to have somebody as experienced and as tenured as Rick at the helm to kind of close out that nonsense and still keep this young group focused on the task at hand?
Yeah, I've been fascinated to watch him because, you know, I think he has really enjoyed with this young group and building something. I mean, this is a guy that's won a title. My first year in the NBA back in 06-07 was his last year with the Pacers in his first tour of duty. And so it's been, for me, just to see, you know, the changes that he's made, you know, as a 20-plus year veteran on the NBA sideline. So I've been very impressed with this staff that he put together. Lloyd Pierce, a former head coach. Mike Weiner was with him in Dallas. Ronald Norad, who I just think is a fantastic young assistant coach. He's going to be a head coach in the NBA one day. Jenny Busick does such a great job. And then you've got somebody like Calbert Chaney and the player development staff. They have put together a really good staff that really clicks with this locker room and this team. And the other thing is when you go to practice or you go to shoot around, it's not just Rick's voice you hear. You hear everybody's voice. I mean, he really empowers his assistant coaches to teach and coach, and that's been really cool to see.
Chris, last question on my end. I think it was Fran Fraschilla that kind of started this, but there's been a number of broadcasters that have been posting, whatever you want to call them, score sheets, spotting charts. For those that aren't play-by-play broadcasters, these would be the sheets that Chris often tweets out that show your information on your roster, scoring trends, all kinds of nuggets and factoids that you're going to use on a broadcast. You mentioned that you keep all of yours. I was wondering if you ever take a peek back and if there's a favorite score sheet or one you're most proud of over the years over your tenure broadcasting games.
That's funny. It's I do have them all. I guess I don't know why my wife asked me, why do you have all these?
That's got to be a tote that's completely full by now.
Oh, Brian, it's mega totes. But the one thing that I did do when we moved 3 years ago, I really organized them all. And I put them in like sort of year by year. And I even have them, like I said, I have all my Indiana Fever sheets that I did for 18 years. I have, I think, most every one of my Butler sheets. So, you know, the one thing is we don't get to go deep into the playoffs. So we only do the first round. So, you know, some of those series back in 13-14 I have. I go back to my Butler days. You know, I've got the NCAA tournament ones. I go back to the Indiana Fever, you know, when the Fever won the championship in 2012. So I probably this summer need to go back through and reorganize again and maybe pull out some of my favorites and put those in a separate tote. You know, I saw Mark Boyle. Mark Boyle doesn't keep any of his. And he's got, I think, a fantastic score chart as well. I just am one of those that I like to keep them. And who knows what I'll do with them one day.
I'm more in Boyle's camp. I just throw those things away as soon as I'm done with them. But good for you, man. You got to frame some of those.
Yeah, I need to do something with them. I mean, I have, you know, I've done Turn 4 at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway for 20-plus years. And I do a pretty elaborate chart to prepare for that because I don't do, you know, many races. I just sort of come into the 500. I come into Brickyard Weekend. So I have a pretty in-depth chart that I put together for those, and I've got those as well. I've got the ones that I've done, Big Ten football, Big Ten basketball. So, yeah, I mean, I'm sure at some point I'll have to make that decision that I'll have to select the ones I want to keep and do something with the others.
Well, I'll let you go study the chart for tonight's game, so you can have a good broadcast tonight. Pacers against Oklahoma City. You can hear it right here on 107.5 The Fan. Chris, thanks for joining us.
All right, thanks. Great to talk to you, Brian. Great to talk to you, Jimmy.
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
One morning, you just walk in with a bag of everyone's faves from McDonald's, drop it on the counter, and say, breakfast is on me. Boom! That's the power of saving money on the McDonald's app. Hope you can handle all that. Save money with the app. At participating McDonald's, must opt into rewards.
Colts coaching search continues. One name that has popped up and has been interviewed already by your Indianapolis Colts, Eric Bieniemy, offensive coordinator for the Kansas City Chiefs. The Chiefs, of course, about to take on a familiar South foe in terms of the Jacksonville Jaguars. That's a familiar team name and an ire to the Colts around town. We turn our attention to a man on the beat with The Athletic. It's Nate Taylor. You can follow him on Twitter at @ByNateTaylor via the Motor Shop and Fishers hotline, themotorshop.com. Nate, I know it's a busy week for you with it being divisional round weekend, but appreciate you taking some time with us all the same and jumping right into it in that front. Eric Bieniemy already interviewed with the Colts. He has been a constant interviewee the last four or five coaching cycles. If the Colts do go that route, what does he bring to the table to Indianapolis as they try to search for this rebuild and their next quarterback?
Yeah, well, first off, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to be with you guys. You know, I find it fascinating that when the league decided to have coaches, this being top level assistant coaches and both general managers, owners, being able to have a discussion, this was last year when the league was trying to figure out how they could manage the coaching hiring cycle to not let it be so fast. Because one of the downsides to Eric Bieniemy's situation is he's always been in the playoffs with the Chiefs since he's been their offensive coordinator since 2018. If Jim Irsay wants to hire Eric Bieniemy, it's going to be fascinating to me because not only is Eric Bieniemy someone who is obviously disciplined mindset, I just think he's probably one of the most qualified candidates if you're actually trying to build an honest rebuild, right? If you're not trying to microwave, hey, can we get back to the postseason in a year? Which obviously you see teams do that year over year, but I think Bieniemy brings not only discipline, but the advantage of understanding how you can scheme your players up to be successful. And I know everyone discusses Patrick Mahomes. He is the league's best player. He will win his second MVP award, you know, momentarily here in a few weeks. But I think when you look at the actual roster that the Chiefs have, the amount of players that have come in and out of that offense outside of Kelce and Mahomes, the Chiefs have made those players by and large better just because Eric Bieniemy is a really good coach, both schematically and learning how to motivate guys, how to use them in the right situations. And the Chiefs are one of the more creative offenses. It has surprised me, obviously, like I think a lot of people have, that Bieniemy has been a part of the most consistent, potent offense in the NFL, learning from a coach who will go into the Hall of Fame the moment he stops coaching, to try to figure out how you could replicate that with the players that are on a different roster so that you could build, whether you want to call it a culture, an environment, just a situation where I feel like if you're an owner, if you're a Colts fan that wants your team to be better from week 17 to where they started in week one, I think Bieniemy is a coach that is qualified enough to be given the chance to sort of prove that he can do that. That, hey, what you see in week one is not the same team you're going to see in week 17. And what has made the Chiefs successful beyond just having really good players is their scheme, their offense sort of evolved as the season moves along.
Bieniemy has interviewed for half the league. And he's 0-for. Why hasn't he been hired to this point, in your opinion?
I'm going to give two reasons. One is, and I think the league basically admitted this, if you are a coach in the postseason, you don't have a lot of time to sort of convince another owner, hey, I'm the guy, if you don't already believe that from an ownership standpoint, which means that you're not having the wide pool of candidates that you normally would. if you're obviously trying to get a coach to say, hey, can you stop game planning for like the most important game of the season and like come talk to us and tell us how you would do things? And I think the second issue is Eric Bieniemy is a former player, so he does not talk in a way that is, I think, new coach speak, or, hey, like, he's not going to get, I don't think, super duper into the weeds of analytics or, you know, game plans. I think he is a more old school coach from a former player's perspective that is not as, I would say, as enticing to hear as maybe Dan Campbell. But I do think he can sort of fit that Dan Campbell lane where, hey, the Detroit Lions are better with Dan Campbell than when they started with him. And then, you know, part of the second reason is NFL owners are stupid. I mean, I say it all the time. Like, there's no science to this, guys. Like, sometimes, you know, at your job, they hire somebody who is not the best quality, not the best candidate. But, like, they have a job, so we'll see if they succeed or not. There's been a lot of coaches who I think were less qualified or had less years of experience than Eric Bieniemy in the last 2 years. Some of those coaches don't have jobs anymore. So sometimes it's just a matter of, hey, maybe this isn't the sexiest option, but is this option going to actually help and improve your organization? Are they going to give your team a better chance to win than they were 2 years ago? I mean, no one really knows that answer because no one's given Eric Bieniemy the job. So if Jim Irsay does this, and all of a sudden in 2 years the Colts are competing with the Jaguars or the Colts are division, you know, winners, Jim Irsay will look like a genius. But honestly, it'll just be because half of the other owners are dumb enough not to see what's in front of them, which is, hey, Eric Bieniemy might not be sexy, but he is a very good coach. And anyone that you talk to, and obviously covering this team for the last 5 years, it's pretty evident. It's just for other reasons, there's been other candidates that have been more appealing for various reasons. And that might mean that you have a quality candidate who just hasn't had a chance and has been very committed on trying to prove over and over again that, yes, we can take Tyreek Hill out and we can still be successful. And, yes, Patrick Mahomes, I know this sounds stunning, guys. He's better than he was in 2018. Part of that is coaching, and you can't just boil it down to one person. But, you know, that's easy for me to say. If the general managers don't see that, or if they want to go with a different direction, then that's their prerogative.
So what would an Eric Bieniemy coach team look like, in your opinion?
This is where it gets fascinating, because I like to tell people all the time that, like, the Chiefs throw the ball all the time. Now, you could answer that and say, well, look, they got the best quarterback. Sure, they kind of threw the ball a lot in Alex Smith last season. I get the sense that Eric Bieniemy is not going to be afraid to pass the ball. He's not going to be afraid to develop a quarterback or to keep a quarterback disciplined. And I know that there are all the highlights of Mahomes doing, like, absolutely nuts stuff. But one of the reasons why the Chiefs are so good is it's hard to blitz them because Eric Bieniemy handles the protection calls alongside Patrick Mahomes. It's hard to stop the Chiefs in the red zone because Andy Reid, Eric Bieniemy, and Patrick Mahomes come up with these very unique, innovative plays for short yardage situations. It's hard to beat the Chiefs because on third down, it's like, well, let's use our most talented players and give them chances to win one-on-one in space, whether that's Travis Kelce, whether that's Juju Smith-Schuster. You know, guys, Jerry McKinnon's been in the league for almost 10 years. He's never had a better season than he has right now. And Eric Bieniemy just so happened used to coach, I don't know, Adrian Peterson, Jamal Charles, Kareem Hunt. He knows how to get running backs to be both effective in the running game and the pass game because obviously he played the position. It's one of his specialties. So you're going to, I think, see a team that's going to be smart on offense. It's not going to be exactly the same way it is right now with Jacksonville and Doug Peterson. It obviously helps if you have the number one pick and you can, you know, go get the quarterback you want that you think you can obviously succeed with in the future. But I just think it comes down to discipline and really motivating guys throughout the course of a season and utilizing those guys in a way that is, you know, just smart. Like, it's so easy to get into, like, the big picture stuff. And I think that's been one of the issues with Bieniemy is like, hey, who's going to be on your staff? How are you going to manage things? You know, what is it going to be like? You know, what's going to be your mantra? And I don't know how he succeeds or how he fails in those type of discussions with owners. But when you just look at it and what the team has done, it's hard to think that they don't have a game plan where the quarterback can't succeed. And that obviously involves Patrick Mahomes a lot. But look, guys, they won 2 games with Matt Moore, who was basically signed off the street because he was coaching high school football in the 2019 season. You know, I like to remind people all the time, Patrick Mahomes had a dislocated kneecap, missed about a month, came back and they won the Super Bowl. They don't get that bye that year if Andy Reid and Eric Bieniemy, who I think are pretty much tied to the hip, and, you know, if, again, if you just want to be a smart owner, Jim Irsay can hear countless sound bites of Andy Reid explaining to us, you know, with me and a lot of my colleagues here in the media in the Kansas City asking the questions, well, like, why is Airbnb better? It's going to be a good head coach. And he's like, because, guys, I've developed like 7 head coaches, and like, I know when someone's ready, and Airbnb is ready, and I give him more responsibility every year. And guess what? The offense stays really, really good every year. So I'd be fascinated, and I would encourage Irsay, when you have some time, you know, if you feel like, you know, Eric had a good interview. And look, there's been a number of years where Andy Reid and Jim Irsay have been in the same owners' meetings on the same locations. And I would just be fascinated to know, like, hey, if you want to compete with the Andy Reids, Sean McDermott in the divisional round, Doug Peterson in the divisional round, Ron Rivera went to the Super Bowl previously when he was with Carolina, coming through Andy Reid's sort of program. Matt Nagy was a coach of the year in his first year doing the job, and he had Mitch Trubisky. So there's a lot of examples, but I just think Eric Bieniemy's team will be disciplined. They're going to have some creativity to them, and I just think he's going to have guys motivated. That's something that I think Travis Kelce has always told me and always reminded me is, because he's a former player, he knows how to get the best out of former players, and then you sort of put the scheme behind that talent, and guys really revere him and respect him here. And so I don't know if it's going to happen, guys, but somebody I think is going to get a pretty good coach if they hire Eric Bieniemy.
Nate Taylor taking some time for us via the Mower Shop and Fishers hotline at themowershop.com. You can follow him on Twitter at @ByNateTaylor, Chiefs writer for The Athletic and host of the Times Ours podcast. Caught some of that episode the other day, Nate, and you brought some PTSD from my Chiefs fanhood by dropping the name Damon Heward into my lap.
Yeah.
I bring that up. I bring that up because the Colts have gone through a similar era of my childhood as a Chiefs fan, of trying to find a quarterback, trying to find their answer. Let's say they go draft first round talent in either Bryce Young or CJ Stroud. People want to point to Patrick Mahomes as a knock against Bieniemy, but shouldn't that be a strength, knowing that he has helped with Andy Reid in this development of Patrick Mahomes, that he can guide a young quarterback through the rigor of the NFL?
Yeah, I really do. And I know this is, again, very schematic, like super football weeds, but it's like, can you just protect the quarterback? And I know that makes sense to like Colts fans. Can you just protect the quarterback? Now, you need talent at the offensive line position, and the Chiefs have had a very good offensive line since Mahomes has been with the team, outside of obviously that Super Bowl loss to the Buccaneers where like half their offensive line was hurt. But yeah, I think you just want somebody to understand, like, where are the checkdowns? What's the down and distance situation? Where could the blitz line be coming from? What are your options to counterattack that? Guys, Mahomes is the best quarterback against the blitz. That's been the case for, like, 3 or 4 years. And I really do believe that comes down to coaching, and that comes down to getting the player to understand what he can get away with, where he can be aggressive, and where he just needs to be ultra-super dynamic when having the opportunity. The Chiefs do not coach Patrick Mahomes to be super duper reckless all the time, but they do use his skills. Obviously, they use him out of structure, out of the pocket. I know that's something that I think probably lends a little bit more to CJ Stroud when you look at him on film and what they're able to do at Ohio State, particularly in the national semifinal game. I'm super duper fascinated by Bryce Young. I haven't watched a ton of him, but obviously he's got a little bit of an issue with, hey, he's coming from Alabama. He is a similar type quarterback from Tua Tagovailoa, who, by the way, had a really nice season when he was on the field and healthy. Can he withstand the punishment of the NFL defenses and obviously in a long 17-game season? That remains to be seen. But the reason why the Chiefs got Patrick Mahomes is because every other team was like, well, he's just another Texas Tech quarterback who throws the ball 50 times a game, which is true. And then he got paired with some of the best coaching that allowed him to both be dynamic but also be disciplined. And one of the things that Eric Bieniemy has really, really tried to get across to Mahomes is, you are so talented. If we just don't turn the football over, we're going to be in the red zone. And then that comes down to, where do we want the matchups to be? How do we want to sort of, you know, pinpoint what a weakness is for a defense? How do we want to be creative with misdirection plays and trick plays? or just somehow to get Travis Kelce open yet again in the red zone. But, dude, if you just don't turn the ball over, we're going to put up points. And I think that's something that every young quarterback has to go through. It's like, we all want you to try hard. We all want you to succeed. But possessing the football is really super-duper important, and you can't put points on the board or give the other team an advantage if you have an issue with that. The reason why the Chiefs lost to the Bengals last year is because Mahomes had turnovers in the second half and obviously in overtime of that loss. But this year he's thrown 41 touchdowns and he's had 12 interceptions. So it's a 3-to-1 ratio, which is excellent for any quarterback who's throwing the ball that much. I assume Bienemy would obviously lean with a young quarterback on play action, on read options to a certain degree, and obviously trying to figure out where the best talent is on the roster. But ultimately, like, you've got to have a quarterback who can understand what he can get away with, what he can't get away with, and, of course, trying to be able to be effective for much of the game when you know the speed of the game is just so much different from college. So it's going to be quite the learning curve, but you would hope that Bienemy and how he builds the staff would allow them to, you know, be creative without having to be so daring by throwing the football deep down the field, which is one of the things that the Chiefs have actually done less this year than last year because obviously they don't have Tyreek Hill, but they've still been one of the best offenses in the league because they've adjusted to the players that they have, which again speaks to coaching and sort of knowing what your players can do well and what they can't do well.
Nate, I appreciate you making time for us. Always good to hear from you. Look forward to following along the rest of the way for the Chiefs and whatever happens with Bienemy. Thanks again.
Yeah, thank you anytime. And if he gets hired, I'd be happy to give out more insight. But I think for Colts fans, you don't want the Arizona Cardinals to sneak in. So I think the two teams that make the most sense for Eric Bienemy are the Colts and the Cardinals. And the Cardinals have, as I've understood it, yet to reach out, but that might change next week.
Thank you again, Nate. I appreciate you, sir.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
You're out here hustling, but you're also using the McDonald's app to have your favorites delivered to your door. That's hustling smarter. Order McDelivery in the McDonald's app at participating McDonald's.
Joining us now via the Mower Shop in Fishers Hotline and themowershop.com, the pride of the South Side himself, the head coach of the UIndy Greyhounds. It is one Paul Cassaro. Coach, thanks for making time for us. 18th in the polls are the Hounds, back-to-back weeks for the first time since March 2020, just before you got there. Coach, what's it mean to have this group right back in the polls and getting the national recognition you guys have worked hard for and continue to work hard for each and every day?
It means a lot. Being a former player and a former assistant here, I have a lot of pride in the program, and it's good to have us back to where we feel like the program should be, but can't be content. You know, we have to, stay humble, keep grinding, and that's what you got to do to stay in places like this. And our guys are doing a great job of coming to work every day, and it's a fun group to be around. They deserve all the credit.
It's got to be cool to have success at your alma mater. Did you see this season coming? Did you before the season started? Did you think that okay, we could be really good this year?
Yeah, I thought so because of what we returned. And, the goal is to, get better every year. And, my first year, we were right around 500. And, that was to be expected. We turned, returned only four players from a team before and a whole new staff. And, finished on a high note. And then last year, we go 19-11 and make it to the conference championship game. So we got, exponentially better from year one to year two. And, we returned a lot of guys. We returned probably eight guys that, played really meaningful minutes on last year's team. And, brought in a couple good newcomers, too. So we felt like that, hey, we might be able to take the same jump from year two to year three that we did from year one to year two.
Head coach of UIndy men's basketball, Paul Cassaro, nice enough to take some time with us on the Mower Shop and Fishers Hotline and themowershop.com for all your residential commercial mowers. Well, as snowblowers, power tools, equipment, services, so much more, they have you covered at the Mower Shop and Fishers and themowershop.com. Coach, this nine-game winning streak you're riding right now, it wasn't like that the Hounds had fallen off prior to that, six wins to three losses prior to this stretch. What's been the biggest thing out of your group over this nine-game winning streak?
Well, Jimmy, I'm going to give you a hard time. We were 6-2. The one was an exhibition against Western Kentucky, so then it counts. I'm going to take every win.
Take every win you can and shove me in a locker somewhere. That's my fault, Coach. I apologize.
It's all good, man. So we were 6-2, you know, which is a solid record. Nothing to be ashamed of at that time. But we have reeled off 9 since, and we're 15-2 now. But I think the main thing is, you know, we have a talented group of guys. We're deep, and you know, even though we were 6-2, you know, we kind of felt like, okay, that's good, but you know, I think this group is, you know, capable of more. And we had a team meeting, and you know, we talked about sacrifice, and you know, we're playing 11 guys, and kind of went around the room and we talked about roles and what it's going to take from each person for our team to be at the team's best, and that, you know, we're going to have to check some egos at the door, and you know, we're going to have to sacrifice some individual, recognition for the greater good. And our guys all said, hey, we just want to win. And that's really cool when you have a selfless group. And it was good because, hey, you know, not only did each individual understand what the team needed from them, but their teammates and their peers heard it as well. And that way, you know, I think since then, everyone's been on the same page. And the main thing is we just got to keep getting better every single day, and hopefully we can keep this thing going.
As you have come through the ranks, who has been your biggest coaching influence?
You know, you're always a product of who you work for, and I've worked for two guys, Stan Gerard here at University of Indianapolis, and, you know, he's probably the biggest because not only did I coach for him, I played for him too. And then, John Kaufman at Purdue Fort Wayne, spent 2 years with him at the Division I level, and that was really good for me too because, you know, for 8 years – under Coach Gerard, you know, who not only, a coach of mine, a boss of mine, he's been a great mentor and almost like a family member to me. That's all I really knew at the college level. So to go to somewhere else and just kind of see a different way of doing things, you know, that was really good too, because it kind of opens your eyes to, you know, other perspectives, other philosophies, and, you know, kind of between the two of those guys and then just kind of some things that, you know, I've picked up along the way, kind of built my own philosophy. So I think what you see is, you know, a little Stan, a little Coach Kaufman, and just kind of some things that I've always wanted to do myself.
You're listening to Paul Cosaro, the head coach at UIndy. And, Coach, I've been saying that mid-major coaches right now have no chance for any sustained success because if a player has a good year, he's gone. He's in the portal, going to try to go to a bigger and better conference. Is that trickling down to the Division II level? Are you seeing the portal now come into play? If a player has a good year at the Division II level, he's now looking to go to D1?
No, I honestly, it hasn't with us, and I disagree from that assessment even at the mid-major level. I think this business is all about relationships, and if you build good relationships with your student-athletes, they're going to want to play for you. If they have success, they're going to realize, hey, I'm having success because, you know, this relationship, this player-coach relationship works. And I want to keep this success. So, I don't see that. You know, when we were at Fort Wayne with John Conchar, who's now with the Memphis Grizzlies, he could have gone anywhere in the country a senior year, and he stayed at Purdue Fort Wayne and was the best mid-major player in the country. And because of that, he was a big fish in a small pond, and he's better off for it and actually got picked up. And he probably wouldn't be where he was today if he would have went to, let's say, Kentucky or Georgia and averaged 9 or 10 points because he was figuring out a new system. You know, I think that was good for him. But for us, we haven't lost anybody to the portal that, you know, we didn't expect to, or, you know, for the reasons that you brought up. You know, our best players every year has returned, and I think it's because of the way we treat our guys. We take care of them. They know we love them. You know, we hold them accountable. We coach them hard. But, you know, we have great relationships with our guys, and I think that's what it's all about. If you can form relationships with your guys and there's trust and you take care of them and they know that you genuinely care about them more than you do about winning, they're going to want to stay and they're going to want to play for you.
Coach, you obviously have your team goals and your group collective focused on those objectives as the season goes on, but it's always nice to celebrate and take a moment to honor individuals when they succeed on the court. Jesse Bingham becoming the 44th Greyhound in program history to reach 1,000 career points on Monday night. As you're a local product yourself, so is Jesse. What did that mean from that connection standpoint, and just to see him reach that mark of 1,000 career points in a Hounds uniform?
You know, Jesse, everything Jesse gets, he deserves, and he earns it because he works so hard. And I'm very happy for Jesse because he's obviously a great player, but he's an even better person, a great young man. I love him. He's been on board from the moment that I got the job here. You know, I recruited Jesse out of high school when I was an assistant here. So I kind of initiated this recruitment at UND. Then I left to go to Fort Wayne. And by the time I came back, he had stayed with his recruitment at UND and was on the roster. And, you know, when I got the job and I kind of called him and, you know, said, hey, I'm going to be your head coach, there was no hesitation. You know, he never batted an eye. He was all in. He wanted to stay here. And he's given me everything. And I owe Jesse a lot. And, you know, I'm just can't – I could go on and on and talk about it. Now, the cool thing about Jesse is he's done this in 2.5 years.
Right.
You know, he still has – you know, 2.5 years because he got that COVID year. So I told him the other day, I was like, hey, man, that's awesome. Let's go get another 1,000. You know, let's become the school's all-time leading scorer. Let's be the GOAT. And hopefully he can do that, and I think he can.
Coach, last question on my end. You welcome in McKendry this weekend for Pack the House. I've seen you and the UND social media team kind of pumping that up. Talk a little bit about that Pack the House tradition and how fans can get involved this Saturday.
Yeah, Pack the House night is, you know, obviously, we want to pack our gym any chance we can. But essentially, Pack the House is kind of our equivalent of like a winter homecoming where we try to get a lot of alumni back, try to really pump it out. And, you know, our goal is to sell out Nickerson Hall. We want 3,000 people here on Saturday. And if you want to see good basketball, that kids that play hard, play the right way, you know, a cheap ticket. It's only, you know, $10 for adults, $5 for kids. Good role models for your kids to look up to. I think this is the place. And, you know, we tip off at 3 o'clock. It's going to be a rocking atmosphere, a good GLBC matchup. We're playing good basketball, and I encourage fans to come out.
Coach, appreciate you making time for us. I've enjoyed watching the success, and best of luck to you now with the calendar year turning to 2023, rooting for the Greyhounds to achieve all those goals you have set, Coach.
Hey, guys, I really appreciate having me on. You guys have a great week.